pleading windows propped open with dog-eared textbooks and plastic yellow rulers. As that last day approached, a certain smell was teased out from all the backpacks, lockers, and gym closets, too. It was a musty combination of dodgeball rubber, cheap floor polish, acne medication, and locker mold. But that heat sure brought some excitement with it, too. Calendar days flipped by, and teachers taught with a bit more pep. Assignments got a little lighter, and project deadlines came and went. Tank tops came out as flip-flops clip-clopped up and down the hallway with everybody locking eyes, smiling big smiles, and waiting patiently for that beautiful last day to finally come. And then one day it did, and it sure whipped by in a whirlwind. Maybe your teacher made a batch of homemade brownies, and everybody sliced a square out with plastic knives while passing around yearbooks and watching a movie with no educational value whatsoever. Maybe your school wrote tests and exams earlier, so half the class skipped while the rest played Battleship, watched students versus teachers baseball, or just collected their report cards. Maybe you were graduating and spent the afternoon kicking pebbles in the parking lot and chatting about all the moments you were going to miss as you moved on. There was your first cigarette, getting cut from the basketball team, and the hallway drama of prom season. Making plans for pool parties, summer birthdays, and sleeping in every morning gives you a great rush, and as you walk home with that pen-scratched yearbook, you squeeze out a small smile and stare way off into the distance of July and August, thinking tall thoughts and dreaming big dreams to fill those beautifully wide-open spaces. Awesome!
When you're right near the end of the book. You've been through so much together. It seems like ages ago when you first cracked her open, flipped past the small print mumbo-jumbo, and read that first sentence. Maybe you knew you'd like it, or maybe you judged that first page harshly, playing hard to get, eyeing the others on the shelf, seeing if this puppy was really worth your time. But then, you got sucked in. Characters grew, and a few chapters ended with cliffhangers that kept you up much too late. You laughed as you flipped and flipped on a long flight. Your eyes welled at the cottage, and you cozied up through big scenes under an old blanket on the front porch. When you're right near the end of the book, you feel the anticipation pulsing. As you sit still in absolute perfect silence, it's amazing how your mind is racing, your heart is pumping, and your ears tune out the world around you. Maybe you put the book down to go to the bathroom, or grab a glass of water, trying to guess the ending just before you read it. Will she find her mother? Will he admit how he feels? Will Gryffindor win the house cup? Maybe you savor those last few pages. Maybe you race right through them. Or maybe anticipation gets the best of you and you flip right to the end. Either way, pretty soon you're closing that book with a satisfying shut and adding it to the freshly read pile on your shelf. Finishing a book makes you feel good. You're almost there. Awesome.
Smiling and thinking of good friends who are gone. I met Chris Kim in September 2005 in Boston. A tiny Korean guy with thin eyes hidden behind thick glasses under a well-worn and faded ball cap. He looked kind of mousy under awkwardly baggy clothes and behind a soft voice. And even though neither of us drank much, we met at a bar. Me speed-sucking a gin and tonic through a needle-thin straw, him warming a well-nursed beer and occasionally taking baby sips. When he mentioned he was from Boston, I asked about the Red Sox, and he played along well enough. Big win last night, he offered cautiously. Maybe still have a chance at the playoffs? Of course, that launched me on a rant about the bullpen and whether Curt Schilling had enough steam for another big run. He nodded on, listening intently, asking genuine and serious questions, and letting our friendship take root over sports, of all things. Of course, he never watched the stuff, but was nice enough to let me talk mindlessly about it all night. Full of wry smiles, awkward pauses, and mock serious faces, Chris was a complex, fascinating, creative person who grew into a remarkably close friend during the 2 years we went to school together. He got excited about little things, like caramelizing onions perfectly for an hour on low heat, getting randomly selected to fill out a survey of his radio habits, or learning a new keyboard shortcut in Microsoft Excel. But it wasn't the bar scene that helped our friendship bloom. It was the car scene. Yeah, when I showed up to class on our first winter morning, shivering to the bone in a flimsy nylon coat, my hair wet, my face dripping, Chris asked where I lived and if I needed a ride the next day. As I was, at that moment, toweling my face off with a fistful of balled-up Kleenex, I took him up on it right away. Lucky for me, Chris had signed up to be a senior student in an undergrad residence way off campus, spending his free time for 2 years chaperoning social events, holding heads above toilets, and editing 2 or 3 resumes a night at a steady clip. Anyway, he began picking me up every morning for the next 2 years, probably at least a couple hundred rides, never once accepting money for gas because, as he said, I'm going that way anyway. When other students heard about my taxi service, they got in on it too. It started with a, "Hey Chris, if there's a blizzard tomorrow, can I catch a lift?" and turned into Chris emailing 3 or 4 of us each night, giving us the bus schedule, as he called it, timed precisely to the minute for the next morning. And so it went, us piling into his car after he'd spent the first few minutes warming it up for us, tightly blanketed in fat mittens and his trademark big blue hat. Last year, I nervously started up the website that inspired this book, tentatively dipping my toe into cyberspace where anyone could see. Chris, of course, adopted his Mexican half-brother pseudonym, San Carlos, and peppered the site with comments of support from the get-go. On popping bubble wrap, he wrote, "I learned on the news that bubble wrap is a fantastic insulator because of the trapped air, so if you're cold, do not pop it, but wrap yourself in it." On paying for something with exact change, he wrote, "I save all my pennies in my car. And then the next time I do McDonald's drive-thru, I fling all the pennies into the server's face. No, actually, I put the pennies into the Ronald McDonald's House box underneath the window." On playing with a baby and not having to change its diaper, he wrote, "I don't mind changing my nephew's diapers. It only got weird when they began to talk. Awkward." I loved his sense of humor and his way about himself. I loved how he laughed, frequently, at little things, and got so excited about tiny details most people overlooked. Chris and I spoke 3 or 4 times a week after we graduated, in 10 or 15 minute snippets usually, but sometimes for an hour or two. He'd tell me about the sourdough bread he was baking that day, the elaborate meal he had planned for friends coming for dinner, or the New York Times article he thought I should check out. I would ask him for ideas for awesome things. He had plenty. And occasionally go on long rants about sports. Chris died suddenly last year. He was 32. No amount of the usual closing rhyming couplets or fist-to-the-sky proclamations are going to bring him back. But I know he's in a peaceful place and would want us all to just be happy, keep plugging, and enjoy our lives as fully as we can. So, thank you, Chris. You'll always inspire me. And you'll always be so incredibly awesome.
Remembering how lucky we are to be here right now. Over dinner one night, my dad started telling me about his first day in Canada. It was 1968, and he was 23, arriving on a plane with $8 in his pocket to start a new life by himself in a country he had never visited. "A community group had a welcome dinner for new immigrants," he started excitedly. and they had a big table of food. I was unimpressed. A table of food, I agreed flatly, while staring straight ahead and flipping past baseball highlights on TV. A table of food, he continued. Basically, Neil, all the presentation of the picnic food on the table, I didn't recognize. There were two or three kinds of salad. Potato salad, macaroni salad, maybe coleslaw. Probably four different kinds of sandwiches. Ham sandwich, turkey sandwich, chicken sandwich, roast beef sandwich. Then there were the main courses, they called it, you know, tuna casserole. Then the dessert was pies, which I never seen pies before. I put down the remote and glanced at him cockeyed. Behind the thick, boxy glasses, I could see his eyes darting wildly. How did you know what everything was? My brother was there, so I will ask him, and he told me whatever it is. The trays of cold cuts was different. Instead of regular chicken, they have sliced them. Sometimes they have them rolled with the toothpick in them. I had never seen cold cuts before. I seen chicken in chicken form, but not rolled up. Same for cheese. Some were in slices, some of them in squares. What did you eat? I asked. I ate everything. That's the only way to get to know. I can't believe how many different things you can get here. My dad would take me to the grocery store and marvel at the signs beside every fruit. He was fascinated that pineapples came from Costa Rica and kiwis were shipped from New Zealand. Sometimes he came home and opened an atlas to find out where the countries were. Somebody brought dates from Morocco and dropped them 5 minutes from home. He'd just smile and shake his head. But if I really stopped to think about it, a lot had to happen before we could be here right now. A lot had to happen before we could buy bananas from Ecuador and eat turkey cold cuts. Before we could flip through books about warm underwear and cool pillows. Before we learned to read anything at all. Before we grew tall. Before we could talk. Before we could walk. Before we were even born. So let's stop for a second and pull back. Let's pull way, 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 way back. Okay, you used to be a sperm. Now don't get self-conscious. We all used to be sperm. Check out the period at the end of this sentence. That tiny little dot is around 600 microns wide. When you were a sperm, you were about 40 microns wide. And you were so cute back then, too, with your little tail wagging all over the place and your love of swimming. Boy, could you swim. In fact, if you hadn't outswum your siblings, you might be a slightly different version of yourself right now. Maybe you'd have a higher-pitched laugh, hairier arms, or stand 2 inches shorter. You had a great life as a sperm, but always felt incomplete. The truth is, you weren't whole until you met an egg. And then you two began a 9-month project to make a cool new version of you. It took a while, but you grew arms and legs and eyeballs and lungs. You grew nerves and nails and eardrums and tongues. For a sperm to meet an egg, it means your mom met your dad. But it's not just them. Think about how many people had to meet, fall in love, and make love for you to be here. Here's the answer. A lot. Like, a lot, a lot. Before they had you, none of your ancestors drowned in a pond, got strangled by a python, or skied into a tree. None of your ancestors choked on a peach pit, was trampled by buffalo, or got their tie stuck in an assembly line. None of your ancestors was a virgin. You are the most modern, brightest spark of years and years and years of survivors who all had to meet each other in order to eventually make you. Your 19th century grandma met your 19th century grandpa down at the candle-making shop. She liked his mutton chops, and he thought she looked cute churning butter. Your Middle Ages grandpa met your Middle Ages grandma while they both poured hot oil from the castle turrets on pillaging Vikings. She liked his grunts, and he thought the flowers in her hair made her heaving bosoms jump out. Your Ice Age grandpa crossing the Bering Bridge in a woolly mammoth fur met your Ice Age grandma dragging a club in the opposite direction. He liked her saber-toothed necklace, and she dug his unibrow. Your ancient rainforest grandpa was picking berries naked in the bush, while your ancient rainforest grandma was spearing dodos for dinner. She liked his jungle funk, and he liked her cave drawings. If it wasn't for the picnic they had afterward, maybe you wouldn't be here. You're pretty lucky all those people met, fell in love, made love, had babies, and raised them into other people who did it all over again. This happened over and over and over again for you to be here. Look around the plane, coffee shop, or park right now. Look at your husband snoring in bed, your girlfriend watching TV, or your sister playing in the backyard. You are surrounded by lucky people. They are all the result of long lines of survivors. So you're a survivor, too. You're the latest and greatest. You're the top of the line. You're the very best nature has to offer. But a lot had to happen before all your strong, fiery ancestors met each other and fell in love over and over again for hundreds of thousands of years. So let's stop for a second and pull back again. Let's pull way, 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 way back. Okay, let's go on a field trip. Put your shoes on because we're heading outside. Take a bowling ball and drop it on the edge of your driveway. That's our sun. Yeah, the ball is only 8 inches across, and the actual sun is 800,000 miles across, but that's our scale for this little brainwave. Okay, now, walk down your street 10 big paces and drop a grain of salt on your neighbor's lawn. That's mercury. Take 9 more paces down the street and drop a peppercorn for Venus. And then take another 7 paces. So you're now 2 or 3 houses down the block and toss down another peppercorn. You got it. That peppercorn is Earth. Here we are, basking in the blazing sun, 26 big steps away from the bowling ball. Our giant planet is just a tiny speck in the middle of nowhere. But here's the crazy part. It gets a whole lot bigger. If you keep walking, Mars is only a couple more houses away. But Jupiter ends up 95 big paces down the street, out of the neighborhood, and halfway to the corner store. By now, a dog is probably slobbering in the bowling ball finger holes, and kids are flying by you on their bikes, slurping drippy popsicles and wondering what's up with this nut tossing crumbs on the sidewalk, acting out some demented suburban version of Hansel and Gretel. If you want to finish up our solar system, you're going to have to start taking 200 and 300 paces for the remaining planets, eventually dropping a grain of salt for Pluto 1/2 mile away from the bowling ball. You can't see the bowling ball with binoculars, and it's getting cold out for your long walk home. But here's the crazier part. That's just our solar system. That's just our bunch of rocks flying around our big, bright bowling ball star. Turns out, our big, bright star and all its salt grains and peppercorns are racing around a cosmic racetrack with 200 billion other big, bright bowling ball stars, You'd have to cover the entire Earth with bowling balls 8,000 times to represent the number of stars in our racetrack. Did we mention this racetrack has a name? Yep. It's called the Milky Way Galaxy. Presumably because the scientists who first noticed it were all eating delicious Milky Way candy bars late that Friday night down at the telescopes. So, basically, our bowling ball, salt, and peppercorns are flying in the fast lane around a ridiculously giant racetrack galaxy called the Milky Way, with billions and billions of other bowling balls, salt grains, and peppercorns. But are you ready for the craziest part? That's just our galaxy. Guess how many giant racetrack galaxies are in all of outer space? Oh, not many. Just more than we can possibly count. Honestly, nobody knows how many galaxies are out there in the big blackness. All we know is that every few years, somebody stares out a little farther and finds millions more of them just shining way out in the void. We don't know how deep it goes because our rocket ships don't blast off that far, and our thickest, fattest telescopes can't see that far. Now, all this space talk might make us feel small and insignificant. But here's the thing. Here's the big thing. Here's the biggest thing of all. Of the millions of places we've ever seen, it appears as though Earth is the only place that can support life. The only place. Oh, sure, there could be other life-giving planets we haven't seen yet. But the point is that Earth could easily have been a clump of sulfur gas, be lying in darkness forever, or have winters that dip a couple hundred degrees and last 20 years like Uranus. On this planet Earth, the only one in the giant dark blackness where anything can live, we ended up being humans. Congratulations, us! We are the only species on the only life-giving rock capable of love and magic, architecture and agriculture, jewelry and democracy, airplanes and highway lanes. We're the only ones with interior design and horoscope signs, fashion magazines and house party scenes, horror flicks with monsters, guitar jams at concerts. We got books, buffets, and radio waves, wedding brides and roller coaster rides, clean sheets and good movie seats, bakery air and rain hair, bubble wrap and illegal naps. We got all that. But people, listen up. We only get 100 years to enjoy it. I'm sorry, but it's true. Every single person you know will be dead in 100 years. The foreman at your plant, the cashiers at your grocery store, every teacher you've ever had, anyone you've ever woken up beside, all the kids on your street, every baby you've ever held, every bride who's walked down the aisle, every telemarketer who has called you at dinner, every politician in every country, every actor in every movie, everyone who's cut you off on the highway, everyone in the room you're sitting in right now, everyone you love, and you. Life is so great that we only get a tiny moment to enjoy everything we see. And that moment is right now. And that moment is counting down. And that moment is always, always fleeting. You will never be as young as you are right now. So whether you're enjoying your first toothpicked turkey cold cuts and marveling at apples from South Africa, dreaming of strange and distant relatives from thousands of years ago, or staring into the blackness of deep, deep space, just remember how lucky we all are to be here right now. If you feel that sense of wonder and beauty and all the tiny joys in life, then you're part of an international band of old souls and optimists, smiling on sidewalks, dancing at weddings, and flipping to the other side of the pillow. Let's all high-five and keep thinking wild thoughts, dreaming big dreams, and laughing loud laughs. Thank you so much for listening to this book. And thank you for being awesome.
This has been an Audible Studios production of The Book of Awesome. Written by Neil Pasricha. Performed by Therese Plummer, Aaron Moon, Neil Heligers, Jesse Einstein, Josh Hurley, and Kevin Free. Executive producers Kristen Lang and Mike Charzik. Producer Kat Lambrix. Copyright 2010 by Neil Pasricha. Sound recording copyright 2018 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.